gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Monday edition. Today's date is the 13th of August, 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and of course, we've got things to share with you today, as we usually do on our broadcasts. We've got a guest today, someone that is a first-time visitor to the French Connection, and I was happening upon some research, of course, is what I do with much of my day, and I was reading a very interesting article about flights that were that planes that went down with anomalous causes and unexplained reasons, and some of them had some bizarre coincidences around them, and my guest looked into them. One of them was an AWACS type plane, an EC-135N, that was supposed to be sold to the Saudi Arabian government, and there was a lot of problems at the time in Congress about giving the Saudis such a high-tech weapon or a high-tech platform. And another one was an Egyptian plane that went down under some strange circumstances. And in both instances, there were some similarities that this man picked out. His name is Stephen St. John. And Stephen said to himself, wow, this looks like more than a coincidence, and began digging through a lot of this stuff. And he found things that got his attention. And I want to bring that out and a couple of other things. One of them about the USS Liberty we're going to discuss later. And you all know that I have spent a lot of time looking at the Liberty. In fact, if you don't know it, I will repeat it. I was a sailor on the USS America way back in the day. But anyway, I'm going to bring my guest up right now. His name is Stephen St. John. Stephen, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Daryl. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's great. It's great to have you on the show. And I haven't told you, but we get between 10 and 15,000 downloads per day on our information, Stephen. And
that's impressive.
Well, we got a pretty decent audience, and because people have come to trust that we do our due diligence. One of the things that struck me about that story was the Admiral Maurer. The things that came out of some of the people around the U.S. government and what was going on at that time during this. Can you explain the congressional activity that was going on with this plane and maybe some of the strange things that went around that caught your attention?
Yes. First, let me say, may Admiral Maurer rest in peace. He was a great man. I had the honor to meet him a number of times. He was a great USS Liberty supporter, and he really meant a lot to the survivors. And these people were really put through hell, and he held their hand. He was with them right up until the year he passed away, and the Liberty people are forever grateful. Now, with the instance of the EC-135N, that it was not readily recognizable as a AWACS-type plane because the AWACS has the satellite dish in the disc on top of the fuselage, whereas the EC-135N has the satellite dish in a big bulbous nose in front of the plane. One of the planes was named Snoopy after the cartoon character.
Yeah.
That is a good illustration of how the nose looks. And there's a photo of it. You can Google Fly Area, A-R-I-A, and come up with a website there, and you can see photos of these jets.
Yep.
And about 3 weeks before this plane went down, there was a news item, the Reagan administration. This is 1981, the Reagan administration proposed an arms deal with Saudis. And by the way, when we deal with the Saudis, they pay hard cash, I want you to know.
Yeah.
And included in this package were five AWACS jets. And the Zionists went ballistic, and their supporters in the Congress followed the line. To resist this the sale. And I heard said by a source, I picked it up in an elevator. I was in the financial district of Los Angeles at the time, and I heard that it was the Zionists doing it, that they were upset with this plan to sell AWACS. This is how they could express their displeasure by having such a plane go down and killing people important to the training of AWACS personnel. Also, a Bell and Howell employee was on that plane. People important to the program, which could possibly compromise. It wouldn't put an end to it, but it would make it more difficult. But send a warning message to certain people. It's like an intimidation tactic. And all of this, if you're familiar with the Talmud, all of this is consistent with the Talmud.
Meaning, and what consistencies are there in the Talmud that you believe?
You can kill non-Jews. You can steal from them. You could otherwise oppress them. You could use them, manipulate them. It's all a distinction that's made between Jews and non-Jews. It's spelled out throughout the Talmud. You could look at Carol Valentine's website, which is excellent.
It's one of our heroes.
www.come-and-here.com. www.comeandhear.com.
Or you can go. Nesta Webster is also a very good source, or Elizabeth Dillings also.
Well, this is her website is based on Elizabeth Dillings' work.
Yes, that's right.
Elizabeth Dilling was prior to internet. Carol Valentine put it on the internet, so it's at your fingertip. Whenever you hear the strange word Talmud, and most people have no clue, you can go to this website and get a very nice education thanks to these two ladies.
So it's rather scary stuff, isn't it?
Okay, all right, but back to the plane. The plane went
back
down,
to the plane.
And under very strange circumstances, indeed, I requested the report. Mm-hmm. And I think people in the Pentagon were wondering, who is this guy with a back office job in Los Angeles for some stock brokerage company requesting a report on such a disaster? And I did attract some notice. I don't want to go into that. It's a side story, but I definitely feel I was under surveillance, and I definitely feel that these were our Zionist buddies.
Yeah.
And I came face to face with a few of them, and a few of them later became famous, and so I saw their faces in the newspapers.
Namely who,
they
can you say?
They were arrested, Jonathan Pollard and Irv Rubin.
Yeah.
But I don't want to go into those stories, because it's a, maybe another time, but it's a site, we're getting off the issue of this plane.
Okay, so continue, please. Yep.
So in the middle of this debate about the sale of AWACS, this jet goes down. Nobody in Congress made the connection that it was virtually an AWACS. Only people on the inside knew. The public never found out about this. And when I got the report, there were three strange things about it. I just put the report away later and forgot about it. I really didn't press it. But when the Egypt Air Flight 990 went down, I recalled this incident.
Now, where did 990 crash?
South of Martha's Vineyard.
Yep.
Out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And I dug up the report and reread it and realized there were three aspects of it that, I mean, with any, a grammar school student could flag it as something that would need a criminal referral. And that just didn't happen. There was no criminal referral, and there were people who were gaming the system, and they didn't rise to that level. But the three conditions were in the report, anomalous transponder beacon returns.
Yep.
These were distorted in the last 10 seconds or so before contact was lost with the plane.
In both plane incidences, right? Exactly the same.
No. We're only talking about the Air Force EC-135N.
Okay, all right, yep.
This particular aspect did not occur, but there are other aspects that would suggest electromagnetic wave interference. And this is what I believe explains the anomalous transponder beacon returns. They were distorted. One might not show the altitude, whatever. And it was anomalous and unexplained and really not very, very strange circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Plus,
mm-hmm.
The plane was in autopilot, and it suddenly went into full nose-down position There was no black box, but all the debris, it was overland near Frederick, Maryland, all the debris was recovered, and the investigators were able to see for themselves that this plane was in full nose-down attitude. The pitch trim was set for full nose-down. And to go from automatic pilot to full nose-down is a very strange condition indeed. And that was never satisfactorily explained. And electromagnetic wave interference, remote control piloting, that was possible in those days. I feel that it was possible that such a plane could be put in a nose-down position.
Uh-huh.
And furthermore, there was a cloud cover that day at 2,000 feet, but there were witnesses on the ground who saw the plane come out of the cloud cover at 2,000 feet. The plane was still intact.
Yeah.
But at that moment when it appeared, it exploded. And from investigation of the debris, it was determined that the explosion occurred inside the pressurized cabin of the fuselage where the passengers are. And this is a very strange circumstance.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain an explosion just by itself, but it's hard to explain an explosion along with sudden nose-down attitude.
Well, let's give the listeners an idea here, and I can give you a little bit of rough sketch on this. We've got probably a million flight hours a day of passenger jets, which this one was based on a 707, and almost in no instances does an explosion in the center fuselage happen. With millions of flight time hours of jets worldwide. I mean, this, you do get jets that hit mountainsides, you do get them wind shear, you do get struck by lightning, but to explode and then go, driving into the ground and on a nose-down position is so rare. It's like a one in a million kind of event, or even more than that.
Astronomical odds of it happening. And the two instances that I can name both involve the national security interests of the Zionist state. They were making the statement, we don't want these AWACS in Saudi hands.
Okay.
That this is how pissed off we are that we could do something like this to this jet. And then in the case of Egypt Air Flight 990, which also went into an unexplained nosedive, that's the basic similarity with the Air Force jet. It might have been mentioned, but just in passing, it wasn't really stressed by the tabloids. This Egypt Air Flight 990 had 33 Egyptian officers, many of them generals, and they were all here in the United States attending armaments programs sponsored by the U.S. military. And these same armaments programs were declared a dire threat to the state of Israel by, at that time, Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's communications director, David Bar-Ilan. And I know that because he was interviewed and his articles were published in the Jewish press. And that's a radical right-wing Zionist newspaper published in Brooklyn, New York every week. And at the time, I would monitor it regularly, and I was fully aware of what they were saying about these armament programs, and nobody was told about this in the New York Times or the New York Post or the Daily News. They were saying that this Egypt Air flight pilot had exposed himself to some teenagers in the Pennsylvania Hotel opposite Penn Station on 7th Avenue in New York City, and that he had such shame that he committed suicide and decided to take along 33 Egyptian officers with him and his colleagues and all the other passengers, mainly American tourists, and also not deliver the tire for his friend. He had a spare tire for his friend's car that he lugged on board, went through all of that sweat to bring a tire on board and then commit suicide. Well, of course, this is all nonsense.
Yeah.
And this plane was definitely sabotaged. But the problem, the difference between the Air Force jet that went down in 1981 and this Egypt Air flight that went down in 1999 is that there was no black box on the Air Force jet. There was no recording of the voices. They just knew that the air traffic controllers, they had a normal conversation with the guy just minutes before the problem occurred. They never heard any sound indicating any problem.
Yep.
And but with the Egypt Air Flight 990, of course, you had the black box, you had the recordings, and supposedly he says a prayer that is familiar to all Muslims, and this is construed by the really lurid press of New York City. I mean, really disgusting, despicable, low-down dogs to say this, that this Muslim's prayer was something he said right before his suicide. Now, we can only accept what we heard and what we read at the time.
Mm.
But when 9/11 occurred, and when I got on the internet in October 2002 for the first time, and I started to explore, I came across this name of this genius up in Canada by the name of T. Dewdney, D-E-W.
Dewdney, yeah, T. Dewdney, yeah.
Yes, his first name K-E-E. It's kind of not the usual first name, but K-E-E and D-E-W-D-N-E-Y.
Mm.
He's a mathematics professor at one of the universities up there. It eludes my memory at the moment.
He's a Jewish mathematics professor, actually.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Well, God bless him.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
He is a straight shooter.
Mm.
He did two things. He did cell phone tests and found out that you just couldn't do a cell phone call from those jets on 9/11.
Mm.
Then he went a step further, and this is, I'm going to come back to Egypt Air Flight 990 in a moment about this because it leads into it.
Mm.
He, after he established that you can't do cell phone calls, he also concluded that maybe the air phone calls, which were technically possible, were probably fraudulent as well. And he examined the transcripts, you know, related transcripts of people, you know, oh, I got a call from my son,
yeah,
type of thing. And he studied them. He found that all of them were short conversations. They were kept short. In some instances, they called back again several times. They just basically stated what they wanted in the headlines, really, you know, Arab terrorist hijacking, like that. But they made mistakes. One guy called his mother and said he identified himself by his full name. I don't think, Mr. Smith, you ever called your mom and said, hi, this is Daryl Bradford Smith. I don't think you've ever done that.
No. In fact, wouldn't that be, I wonder what my mother would say.
Well, this woman accepted it, but here's the thing. The voice sounded authentic. And this is where T. Dewdney really focuses in. He came up with the hypothesis that this was digital voice morphing. And lo and behold, you have such technologies. In fact, I use it. I have a program where I can talk. When I write my articles, I talk into a microphone and the text appears on the screen. And I could go from there editing it with my voice or, you know, pressing keys, whatever. Well, not only can you make the text appear on a screen, you could actually duplicate the voice in real time. So, you know the Lebanese singer Farouz?
Yes.
She could pick up a telephone and call Hafez Assad years ago and sound like Ariel Sharon. If you had, you know, Ariel Sharon's voice recorded properly, it takes about 10 minutes to fill all the files on the computer program. Anybody, if you speak the same language, you can duplicate exactly the person's voice. You send exactly
now,
that person.
Now, let me
however,
bring something
however,
up
let me,
here. Let me bring
one,
something.
Let me just add one thing.
Yep.
If you talk for a minute or more or so, you are in a dangerous zone because you might betray ignorance of what the person you're speaking with would expect you to know. So you can give away the game.
Well, here's the interesting thing. We've had some very bizarre two calls from Christopher Bolin. Both of these calls were very uncharacteristic of him, and both of them seemed very odd. And Eric brought up the idea that you know, the first one made him believe like there could have been some sort of false morphing going on with the voice. He wasn't sure, but it wasn't out of the question. It was something we brought up together speaking privately.
Absolutely, absolutely. The technology exists. You could Google it. There was a Washington Post article. The name of the person's on the tip of my tongue. I can't come up with it. immediately, but you could find out about it. Just Google digital voice morphing Washington Post, and you'll find an article about it. And I can't think of one honest application for this. But I could see that people engaged in warfare would use it, and I think that evil people would use it. I think that it's very predatory. It's something that I take a very dim view of. But anyway, when I found out what Key Dudenew was doing, I realized that this had to explain what was going on with the Egypt Air Flight 990.
Yeah.
They recorded this guy's voice when he was sitting in a hotel somewhere on the phone, and then they had an Arabic speaker come in, and it sounded like his voice. The cockpit, when you take over, you have remote control, you could take over the flights of 757s and 767s. It's built in a computer system. It's meant for, to intercept hijackers, but it can serve a nefarious purpose if there are people so disposed to doing so.
You can take it over from the ground?
Absolutely. That's been going on for years, and that's probably why you haven't heard too many reports of hijackings over the last couple of decades. It was a big problem back in the 1960s, and that's why they came up with this technology. And absolutely, this is a real technology. But
so now the 9/11 flights all could have been taken over by the same use of this technology, if you're following the same kind of thinking.
This is what I believe happened. But not only can you take over the flight control, you take over the communication system. You can listen to what's going on in the cockpit, but you can shut off any communication coming out of the cockpit. But with this voice morphing, you could recreate conditions in the cockpit and say and fool people and say this is what was going on in the cockpit. And I believe that this Egypt Air Flight 990 was a practice run for these. I believe the same people who did 9/11 did Egypt Air 990.
Well, I also heard that another flight that went down, not trying to get off the subject, but it's similar, this 800 flight, TWA, had some French Secret Service people on board that went down. There were six of them on board going back to Paris with a report about I think it was missing gold and some anomalous things about gold and money and whatnot, and it was never very clear to me, but there were six of them aboard, and that came out in kind of underground sort of press release, but it wasn't made very public, and I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
No, I never heard about gold and TWA 9/11 and French intelligence officers. Anything's possible, but that needs to be verified.
Yes, it needs for me too, and I've never been. That's why I'm asking you, because I hadn't heard anything confirming any of that as being factual.
No, in my opinion, that was a deliberate takedown of TWA Flight 800 to bring us into war against the Arabs. Pin it on the Arabs. It was basically a 9/11, but the perpetrators realized they have to go, to use one of Donald Rumsfeld's expressions, they have to go massive. Hitting a plane like that with an investigation, they weren't able to clearly get out an Arab connection, although you had one guy trying by the name of Sanders.
Yeah.
And I think he's really a disgusting person to do that. And you have this situation where they realize they didn't get the war they wanted, they have to go massive. And this, so they went massive, and 9/11 happened.
Well, now let's continue on with this with these two planes. What happens in after these planes go down and you start making inquiries? Were there things that started worrying you as you started looking into this? I mean, people starting to pay attention to you, Stephen?
Oh, no. Well, I didn't pursue it after that, but I did feel I was under surveillance. I had Jonathan Pollard come up in a taxi. In Los Angeles, you typically make a phone call to order a taxi. It's not like New York City where you go out and just raise your hand and flag down a cab. And the cab came late. It was a company that I always used. called Veterans Cab, if memory serves me well, and it was almost entirely Russian Jews and, you know, the drivers.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, this guy shows up, and one of my Arab neighbors is out there leaning on the passenger side, looking through the window and talking with him. And I get in the cab, and I immediately see the permit. I'm in the habit. That's the first thing I do when I get in the cab. I look at the driver, and then I look at the permit. And I could see the driver, a white person. I could see the permit. It shows the photo of a black man. And I don't ever recall a black driver for this cab company. And the cab was unusual in that it had red velour upholstery, which was like an upgrade. I had never been in a cab like that with this company. And he was playing American in Paris, Gershwin's American in Paris on a tape deck. And uh-huh. told me he was a music student at USC and that he had performed, he was a pianist, he had performed in Carnegie Hall at one time. And then he shifts, and after I tell him I work in the financial community, he tells me that I could broker a deal if I'm interested. And there's a shipload of rice in a tanker ship off the port of New Orleans. And I wondered to myself, why would this music student who drives a cab to pay his expenses forego such an opportunity and offer it to a passenger? And later, it suggested to me that he might have been operated by Mark Rich, because Mark Rich, although he basically dealt in oil, he did other commodities, and this no doubt involved tanker ships. And that's just a thought I'm tossing out. But anyway, I had no idea who this guy was, and I resolved that if I saw police, I would wave to them and call them over and have them stop the cab and look at the license and, you know, discover what was going on. But that never happened. He didn't know basic streets in Los Angeles. I had to give him directions the whole way. I mean, he didn't know main thoroughfares like Wilshire Boulevard, Vermont Avenue.
Mm.
Anyway, I just had no clue who he was. This was approximately 1981. And when he was arrested in November 1985, I immediately recognized him. I remembered the cab ride, and I wrote a note to Joseph DiGenova, who never responded.
Do you have something else you said?
An old smoke alarm detector in my apartment.
The what now?
And at the time, I didn't know who he was. And the circumstances were very strange because he knocked on my door each morning. And I answered the door. He thought I would be at work, but I stayed home from work on three successive mornings and told me that he's going to do other apartments and will come to me later. And he was waiting for me to be out of the apartment. And finally, I fooled him. I told him I'll be having lunch with a friend around noontime. And when he knocked on the door, I didn't answer the door. So he had to put the key in and open the door. And lo and behold, there I am. And I greeted him and told him my friend had to cancel the luncheon, but go right ahead and do your thing. And they had their drill, and they put in the smoke alarm detectors. And my apartment building must have been the first building to have them installed after a Los Angeles City Council resolution or ordinance actually was passed requiring these smoke alarm detectors, and the execution was prompt. It must have been the first day when the ordinance came into effect. And there were a lot of questions. He was looking around my apartment while he was doing his work. I had maps, Middle East maps, on the wall. I used to wear a T-shirt, Ersatz Israel, which aroused his curiosity.
Yeah.
We had a long conversation, and it was mostly about the Middle East. Never had a clue who he was, but this was approximately 1981 as well, the same year when I came across Jonathan Pollard. About 3 years later, in 1984, I'm in the University of Southern California, Hilton, at a conference, Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Irv Rubin was there to demonstrate, and he was immediately intercepted by maybe 20 LAPD personnel, maybe half of them in uniform, half of them plain clothes, And he was arrested right in front of me, less than 10 feet in front of me. And we looked at each other, and I remembered him, and he remembered me. And at that point, I knew who he was, Irv Rubin.
Yeah.
So I attribute these instances to, I've considered them various types of surveillance and harassment. I attribute them to my having written letters about the USS Liberty and also having made inquiry about this this mysterious downing of this Air Force EC-135N.
Well, we're going to put the article up for the listeners to read, and we'll be able to get, you know, up to speed on it, because I think it's got some interesting questions that it raises. I want to go on to the USS Liberty, because we've done several interviews with James Innes. I told you privately that I thought that that possibly one of the main reasons for this was that the murdering of the prisoners of war, and you said, well, you would agree that it might have been a side issue that was important, but maybe not the prime reason. What was in your view the prime reason? And you did attend the 40th anniversary of that sinking bombing of that ship, and what kind of conclusions had you come up with on the Liberty regarding this? Because somebody started pushing this idea about this Project Cyanide that made no sense to me. It was very clear, if you looked at the events of that period, that Johnson was playing catch-up. He was not a principal in any of the attack in advance. He was somebody doing decision-making as a kind of a cleanup guy in the aftermath. And that was pretty clear by looking at the facts. So Project Cyanide made absolutely no sense whatsoever. And what did make sense was that there was some sort of impetus that was going on during this surveillance that would have caused that to happen, whether it be, but not a false flag attack, as you pointed out. Do you want to go into what your ideas are on this?
Sure. And I appreciate this opportunity to explain this. But let me refer to Operation Cyanide first. Nobody knows what Operation Cyanide is.
Right.
We really don't know. So
it makes no sense to me, Stephen.
Well, if we don't know what it is, it can't make any sense. It's a zero factor. Until we can read exactly what it was, we can't really say anything about it. But basically, people have speculated that the mere fact that the Liberty was eavesdropping, listening to messages, would tip Washington off about an impending attack on the Golan Heights. And at this point in time, it was the Israelis had captured everything they captured except the Golan Heights, and there were calls for ceasefire. And people have theorized that the ship might have put pressure on the Israelis and they didn't want it. But I don't buy that, because there were so many other obvious indicators of what the Israelis were planning on doing, including reports from our own embassy who saw lines of troops being directed up towards the Golan, et cetera. So I don't buy that reason. And then you have the situation of the false flag that they attacked the ship so that we would think the Egyptians attacked it and we would come in on the side of the Israelis. And they were doing mopping up operations at this time. They didn't need our help, number one. Number two, such an attack by the Egyptians would have been entirely implausible. There were many international observers. Moshe Dayan, on the first day of the war, declared air supremacy. That means that they controlled the skies. If the Egyptians could manage to get one plane up, it would be immediately intercepted. This was air supremacy. That was the first day of the war. The attack on the Liberty occurred on the fourth day of the war.
Yep.
So it's just out of the question that the Egyptians at that point in time could have carried out a coordinated air and sea attack on the Liberty. Nobody would have believed it. It would have been impossible to believe. It would have been asking people to accept too large a lie. And these people in this profession are very smart, and they wouldn't chance that. So I say the false flag operation is just so far-fetched, it has to be dismissed. Yeah. However, I have to say that it was advanced, dead in the water, Peter Honum, it bought a lot of time. It bought a whole decade where that was being circulated.
Yep.
And so the atrocities against Egyptian prisoners, they were real.
Yep.
But I don't think they amounted to a reason to attack the Liberty. First of all, such knowledge would have been within the control of the military, not the press. So it would have been vetted. It never would have reached the press. So I don't think the Israelis had any fear of that. And by the way, they almost annihilated a sick unit wearing UN blue helmets on the first day of the war. One guy played dead, and that's why he survived, and that's how we know the details of it. This was cold-blooded murder. The UN column had actually went to the side of the road to let the advancing Israelis pass them, and Israelis pulled up alongside and just opened fire. Very callous. And again, this, I think of the Talmud, this is a license to kill. These are non-Jews, and they're in our way. They're not useful. In fact, they're an annoyance to them, and this is how these people think. And I'm not being anti-Semitic saying this. I'm telling you, these people are anti-Goy. Anti-Goy is more of a problem.
Yes.
And this is how they think. So anyway, those are the reasons that have been advanced that I dismiss. Now, let me go into the reason why I think they attacked the USS Liberty. And that was because, of course, as everybody knows, the USS Liberty, being an electronic eavesdropping spy ship, could not only overhear messages, it could record them and send them back under the right conditions in real time to the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland,
yep,
for analysis.
Hmm.
Nothing in the airwaves could get past the ship, anything and everything, any electronic pulse in the air, even static, it would pick up everything and send it back to the NSA. And when the attack occurred, it was in optimal conditions for such messages to be sent back in real time. So they didn't want us, the U.S., to know what was going on. And what was going on? Well, as I said before, the Golan Heights was the only remaining objective point of
yep.
as of the fourth day of the Six-Day War. Everything else had already been captured. And they were planning on taking it, and they took it. But it was not so much the intention. That was already known, and it could have been known from other sources. Not the intention they wanted to take it, but the manner in which they took it. They overran the Golan Heights in less than 24 hours. The Golan Heights was called the Little Maginot Line. It was very well-fortified high ground with concrete-reinforced bunkers, one behind the other, and the Israelis overran it in less than 24 hours. I like to call it the taking of the Golan 123, in the manner of that movie, the taking of the Pelham 123, where a New York City subway train is hijacked.
Yeah.
Well, they took it very quickly, and the Liberty would have missed what was going on, and I speculate, it's educated speculation, that what they missed would probably have been lack of clear command and control from the Syrian high command. And lo and behold, the defense minister of the Syrians, Hafez Assad, 2 years later becomes the only man in world history to rise to the position of head of state after he loses a significant portion of his nation's sovereign territory. That's just as far-fetched as capturing the Little Maginot Line in less than 24 hours. And then to bring it more, to give it more contemporary meaning, the Assads, now his son, who I think is a very good man, is in charge of Syria. He is an Alawite. An Alawite is an offshoot sect of Shiism.
Yep.
He's a Shiite ruling a nation that is largely a Sunni, predominantly Sunni nation. And this
mm-hmm.
doesn't make sense according to what we're hearing in the news about Sunnis and Shiites.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the disinformation that we're hearing. The Syrian nation is very cohesive. They have very good relations. You can visit Sana, sana.net, I think. It's dot something, Khan.org or net. And you will see the parade of visitors that Bashar Assad receives in the palace. He is well-liked by many world leaders. And he was out of the loop on this. It was his brother, Basil, who was groomed to succeed his father, Hafez Assad. Bashar was studying ophthalmology. He became an ophthalmologist, an eye doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he is married to an English lady. And I don't think he had anything to do with this. I think he's a sincere person who wants to rule his country in peace. He wants the law, the Security Council Resolution 242, implemented. You really don't need negotiations. You just need to get off the Golan Heights. But if necessary, he's willing to negotiate. And the Israelis want to isolate him and or make sham pretense of making peace, because in their eyes, the Israelis' eyes, they already have a deal that was sealed with Hafez, that they basically bought the Golan Heights and brought Hafez Assad to power. Now, Hafez Assad had the long view, knowing that if he did such a deal with the Israelis, international law would sooner or later catch up with them and make it not viable. They would have, you know, they would always live under the pressure of international law. They'd have to give it back. So he intended long-term non-performance of his end of the deal. It reminds me of William Randolph Hearst when he was running his newspapers. He was doing an expose of utility fraud in San Francisco, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And the utility head got wind of the report and went and offered a $5,000 bribe not to run the report. And Hearst said, oh, fine. He took the $5,000 and ran the report the next day. And the guy just couldn't go to court and get his money back, you understand? So there was non-performance, you might say dancing with the devil, that type of thing.
I
think that was Hafez Assad's strategy. But, of course, you have this guy, Kadam, who's in France. He suddenly left in the huff. I think this was last year or the year before.
Yep.
He was Hafez Assad's right-hand man for 30 years. He knows where all the skeletons are buried. And he is a billionaire. People describe him as a billionaire anyway. I haven't done a check of his bank accounts, but he lives in France. And I like to call him the USA's king of Syria in waiting. This is what they intend to do. And now that Sarkozy's there, who is very warm with our friendly Zionist buddy neocons, this may come to pass.
Mm.
I hope it doesn't. I'm saying this to alert people to what is possible on the horizon and hopefully to head it off.
Yeah.
I would like to see Bashar Assad stay in power. I would like to see him conduct legitimate peace with a truly even-handed broker. And I'm beginning to think, and I'm sorry to say this because I'm an American citizen, but that even-handed broker of peace might not be the United States.
I certainly
might
not
have worn at our welcome.
Well, certainly not. I mean, in my view, the United States government is not representative of the public, and it's we the people. So I think it's their people that are in charge, not we.
Right. And don't forget, our Constitution says that every treaty made becomes the supreme law of the land. It equates treaties with the Constitution itself. This is language written right in the Constitution. And, you know, there are people who criticize the UN. They want us to get out of the UN. And there are merits to their arguments, but I feel that it is a treaty obligation. We ought to honor it and not use it. We use that institution, and we create a great deal of resentment. I think that if we were fair-minded we would have better coexistence with other nations.
Well, if you read any depth about the the UN's whole game plan,
some sort of
Stephen, I think the whole UN's whole game plan is hello,
free association of nations that
Stephen
come together and make decisions that affect them globally, and you know you have to address federations on that scale. So
Stephen,
I definitely believe in the UN.
Stephen,
we are the major problem there.
Stephen, can you hear me?
We took Yugoslavia apart. We made the UN Charter a joke on Yugoslavia. Well, that's your interpretation.
It's not just my interpretation. It happens to be the interpretation of Dennis Halliday as well in private conversation, as well as Hans von Sponeck, who also was like third in charge of the United Nations at one point. It also is the interpretation of a guy named Anwar Ali's ex-wife, who was a leader of Pakistan, who told me point blank that the United Nations is set up to be an arm of the Jewish supremacists. And that has been going on for a very long time. And in fact,
look, I'm against that. I'm against having the UN as the arm of Jewish supremacists and their allies. But that doesn't mean I'm against the UN per se. I am for the UN, but against that type of abuse, and I feel that that is one of our major goals, to root out that type of abuse, that type of bias. It's really institutionalized bias. I recognize that. It's a very grave problem.
Well, I think it was set up by them to control, Stephen.
Well, then we co-opt it. People like us need to co-opt it. Take it over. Take it out of their hands. Put it in our hands.
Well, that might be something we should do, but in its present form, it is a useless organization. In its present...
All right, I can't argue there. They did something to Yugoslavia that was dreadful and against the charter, and they sponsored a really mean-spirited sanctions against Iraq. And let me tell you this. There were people who knew, as of 1991, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Of course.
That wasn't some lie that was just concocted and uncovered in 2002, 2003.
That's right.
That was a 12-year lie, so they could make a mean-spirited sanctions regime to destroy these people. And not only were they destroying them economically, they were destroying their water system. This is beyond human depravity. These are very severe war crimes that deserve a capital punishment.
But you have to understand, Stephen, you have to understand, too, when they attacked Yugoslavia was on the system of a gold-backed dinar. And, in fact, every dinar that was exchanged there had a backing in their – they were not part of this fiat money international banking system.
Well, God bless them.
Well, the reason they could take it over was because they weren't a member.
Right. And you know what was competing with that system that you just described?
What?
A black market. And
well, that's right.
That black market was actually dominated – and that black market was based on the German mark.
That's right.
Shortly after they did what they did to Yugoslavia, they pulled the rug out under Milosevic, who had every right in the world to maintain the integrity of Yugoslavia. Shortly after that, the mark suddenly morphed, of course, as we all know, into the euro.
Yeah.
So, but that was, that's on Germany's account, Yugoslavia. They are the ones who pushed it, and we very weakly allowed it to happen. We knew better. The argument against it was articulated. Even Henry Kissinger said that we are going afoul of the charter. And I never knew that Henry Kissinger would even care about such things. But
he's one of the top Zionist leaders of this whole criminal group.
Right. Well, if it could happen to Yugoslavia, it could happen to... what's that place in Palestine, do they call it?
Yeah. Well, you know, Stephen, when we're looking at this stuff, what I believe is coming here, and I'd like to maybe get your input on this. I know a lot about money and finance. I've spent a lot of time studying and understanding financial systems, and We're at a point right now, a tipping point in financial markets. Basically, it's being kept alive by smoke and mirrors. We've had this. We have this system where gold no longer is behind anything, and all of our central banks have sold into private hands the gold reserves. And what we've got here is that these international criminals that we're talking about have bought up most of the world's gold supply. So if we go back to a gold standard, what we're basically going to be doing is handing over the entire financial system to these people, lock, stock, and barrel, without a fight. Now, who pointed this out was Bill Still in his Money Masters video, but he also told me privately that the worst idea was to go back to a gold standard, because the gold principally is controlled by the same group that we're trying to get rid of.
Yeah, I can follow that logic. This would make someone like Ron Paul a sleeper on their side, wouldn't it?
Oh, boy, does it ever. And you have to listen to my stuff on Ron Paul. I mean, come on. He's a sleeper. This is what I've come up with. Either that or he's just a dumb stick. I mean, but come on. He's still saying Bin Laden attacked us on 9/11, Stephen. Come on.
Had it happened, had we gone on the gold standard, let's say back in the days of Kennedy, it would have been all right. But
that's right.
At this stage, I could see your point where they have actually taken over all the gold. But I also question all the gold, because I have heard that the Saudis have more gold than they have oil. That's one of their big secrets. They have more gold than oil. They have mountains of gold.
Well, isn't that why Saudi Arabia is on the radar? They're on the radar for attack, too, as soon as part of this three-phase plan is to get rid of Iraq, get rid of Iran, and then take Saudi as well.
Well, in this case, I'm going to write in Vladimir Putin if I go to the polls. And I didn't go to the polls in 2004. That's the first time I have in my life that I missed a presidential election. I elected not to go. I saw no difference between the two candidates. One was, for an illegal war. Another one was hesitating about an illegal war, not calling it by its true name. And I just hope that Vladimir Putin comes forward and doesn't disappoint people who are counting on counterbalance. And I'm not talking Cold War. I'm talking, stopping people in their tracks. It's predatory criminal behavior.
Well, he did take back the Abramowitz and the Berezovsky theft from Yukos Oil and whatnot, but he also just did a little private deal with Kissinger not long ago. So we're not privy to what was said during that meeting, but I would have loved to have some knowledge of what went on in that little discussion they had, huh?
Well, yeah, we don't know what was said, but I don't know if a deal was made. Maybe it was a warning given.
Well, it's possible. I mean, now, what we've been able to come up with here is that there is a martial law setting being arranged for America, and the proof of that is, why would they put all these martial law regulations and presidential directives in if they didn't intend to use them? And, of course, you don't go and gut the Constitution wholesale in a five-year period if you don't intend to use the laws that you're passing. And it looks like all of these elements are all the ducks for these people are in a row right now, but there are too many people waking up to the crimes they've done. And they're kind of in a tough spot. Pandora's box is open. A lot more people are aware of what's happening around them, although it's still a minority. What is your take on what these people have planned for America?
I answer that with great trepidation. I'm thinking somebody might knock on my door.
Well, they just might.
Well, my strategy is to be out in the open, and I write little articles, short articles. They begin in the third person. Some people don't like that, but it actually mimics diplomatic language. And I send two articles by fax broadcast to every embassy in Washington, every mission to the UN here in New York City, every member of Congress, every senator, every member of the House, at all their offices, and many others besides. And then I also email, for, you know, the same text of the fax broadcast. In fact, now that I have your, email addresses, both you and Eric, I would like to, add you to my, distribution list.
Certainly.
And, okay, I'm gonna do that. And, my strategy is to be out in the open. I think that's my best protection.
Yeah. No, but I mean, what do you think for the American public? I believe that they are, if they do nothing, they're going to lose terribly. I mean, the truth about...
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that we might live in a fluoride gulag.
That's possible.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, or the television hypnosis gulag.
Yeah, but do you know that fluoride...
Yes, it dumbs you down by 10% of your intellect, yeah.
It was tested on the prisoners in the Soviet Union. And by the way, those prisons were largely run by our Zionist buddies.
That's right.
And our Zionist buddies are the ones who killed the Tsar and his family.
That's right.
And have been doing similar things ever since.
Yep.
They have a track record, and it seems that you are automatically branded anti-Semitic if you want to talk about it.
That's right.
We have right here in New York City, I'm on 88th Street, and I think it's 63rd or 64th Street, we have the Jewish National Fund. This is a trust for all the land in Israel that is it's the inalienably Jewish land. Inalienably Jewish land. This is against the grain of what we believe, but we not just tolerate it, we praise it. We allow it, we praise it. Even after we had a lesson learned from Chief Justice Rehnquist in the hearings, when he was nominated to be Chief Justice, elevated from Associate Justice, Ted Kennedy and another senator, I can't recall who it was, they zeroed in on Rehnquist. We found your property deeds, Vermont and Arizona. You had two properties. Both had what are known as discriminatory restrictive covenants. You cannot sell this property to a black or to a Jew. And this guy wants to become our Chief Justice? Are you kidding me? And Chief Justice Rehnquist ably defended himself by saying he never saw these deeds himself. His lawyers handled them, and they considered these clauses, offensive clauses, to be non-binding because of the civil rights legislation, that they couldn't ever be enforced, and that they were neutralized, and they just didn't bother with it. But Rehnquist said, I have ordered them to remove those clauses, to redraw the deeds, and they were taken out, and he was elected to be the Chief Justice. But the lesson learned is that we don't allow discriminatory restrictive covenants. I believe in birds of a feather flock together, et cetera, et cetera, but legally we don't allow them. That is an American value. It's an American value that I support. And it is a value that goes against the grain of our Zionist buddies.
Yeah, it sure does. In fact, I had a conversation with the Bishop of Jerusalem on this show, the Anglican Bishop of Jerusalem, who talked in depth about the Christian community over there being subjugated and actually decimated by Zionist criminals, and that he had a 30,000 member flock in his church. It's down to 3,000 now, but they've either killed them off or got them to kick them out of the country.
I don't think the New York Times has ever written about the dwindling Christian population in the Holy Land. They have never written one word about it.
Well, you'd like to maybe tune into that interview that I did. It's on the archives.
Sure.
IamTheWitness.com.
I will definitely be there.
Yeah,
I'm going to check it out. And
well, what we're going to do? We're going to leave these questions we've raised on their merits, and there'll be other questions, and possibly if you're of a mind, we can maybe visit each other again and discuss other.
Yeah, I deeply appreciate what you've done to let me speak on these issues. I think they're very important, and I believe that there is a definite attempt to suppress.
Well, take a look at what happened with this Christopher Bolin situation for us, because he is a dear friend. We're hoping he's still with us and his family. And, you know, he had Thanksgiving dinner here in France with me, with his wife and children. And, you know, it's painful to think that somebody as important as Christopher, who, you know, got Odigo on the front burner, who got Shanksville, he's one of the first to talk about that. He discussed these molten metal coming out of them. He did so many, groundbreaking stuff.
Right.
And all of a sudden,
the company that was taking delivery of these items in the World Trade Center. Yeah.
Well, you know, so much of this stuff that would have probably not seen the light of day or at least been delayed by a long time was brought forward by Christopher, and now all of a sudden what we've got here is Chris's is, you know, he's missing in action here, and we've got the possibility that voice-controlled, computer-generated, you know, conversations are being done, or he's been taken, and because when Eric talked to him the last time, he's sick to his stomach, his wife is sick, he's got nervous problems. This does not sound like a guy who's having a nice summer.
It sounds like poisoning. I pray to God that everything will be okay with him.
Yeah.
And I respect him, and I would like to line up with him and fight the same battle that he's fighting.
Well, we're all in the same boat here fighting, and I want to thank you for spending this time with the French Connection. And I will be in touch with you, Stephen, and I'm going to take a look at some of your other articles just to get up to date with what you've researched.
Okay,
and I know Eric forwards you his great thanks for coming on the show today. You know, we're a little bit less forgiving with people we see working with the wrong people. So don't take offense to the fact that when we see people that are working with others we don't trust, we say it. We're not trying to create mud inside the movement. What we're trying to do is say, wait a minute, we've seen some anomalous associations that we don't like, and when we see them, we say it. So because we think
about it. Yep.
Well, we think oftentimes these people are trying to become the leaders of this movement. We've seen the Phil Bergs of the world. We've seen the people in the 9/11 truth.org people trying to control the message and not talk about the Jewish connection to this and the Zionism involvement. And so we need to tell the world when we see things that are anomalous that we see them.
Well, I think that's the right way to proceed, and I think I have the impression, the general impression, that is the route that you're taking, and I commend it.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on, and I'll be in touch with you, and I hope all stays well with you, sir. And Eric, I'm sure, thank you as well. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Stephen St. John, somebody who has done his own parallel research to many of the things we've discussed here. We're going to probably be able to field your questions for Stephen and maybe pose them to him for another interview. But until that time, ladies and gentlemen, this is Daryl Bradford Smith thanking you very much for tuning in today and telling you be well. Please, bye-bye now.